The retirement and IRA show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Salnier and Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.
This is the Retirement and IRA Show coming to you from beautiful Northern Colorado. Join us as certified financial planner Jim Salnier, as well as Colorado State University finance instructor and certified financial planner Chris Stein, teach you about IRAs, 401ks, annuities, Social Security, pension plans, and estate planning in a fun and enjoyable show. Whether you are listening live in Colorado or streaming from their website or iTunes podcast, Jim and Chris want you to know that they're available to help you plan for your retirement. Just visit their website at jimhelps.com. That's Jim, H-E-L-P-S.com. And click the Meet the Team button on the homepage. Now here's Jim and Chris with today's show.
Well, hello and welcome to the Retirement and IRA Show Q&A edition for this week. I about said good morning, only because we're recording this a little earlier in the day than normal. Not that you would know, you'd be listening to this at whatever your normal listening time is, but we're fairly early today, although Jim's back east, so it's not as early for him. Although just yesterday he was in the Colorado time zone, so it probably still feels a little bit early. Although last I heard, Jim rolls out of bed about 4 o'clock in the morning and starts working on stuff, so maybe this isn't that early for him. We can let him share that with us. Today we've got a fairly standard show, is my understanding. Start with some Social Security questions and then dive into whatever comes out of the goodie bag that Jim has full of questions from all you listeners out there. So we have fairly limited time today, so my guess is banter will be relatively short, but you never know. So, Jim, glad you made it to Florida fine.
I did make it to Florida, and I will keep my banter to a minimum, but I do have to complain about something.
Uh-oh.
And get your opinion, but also maybe the opinion of listeners to see if I was out of line. Because, you know, flying is not a pleasurable experience anymore.
I think everybody been for a long time, yeah.
No. So I get on Southwest, which is the cattle rush. You don't get an assigned seat, at least right now. I believe they're going in that direction. But irrespective if I had an assigned seat or not, I had an aisle seat. I prefer an aisle seat. At my age, as a man, I like to be able to go to the bathroom when I want. So I had an aisle seat, okay? Mm-hmm. And then there was an older woman, probably in her 70s, against the window, empty middle seat. And then it's always the last few people coming on, they got to take the middle seat, which is, again, is no big deal. Mm-hmm. So this woman grabs the middle seat, Chris.
Yep.
She is carrying a pocketbook that could have doubled as a beach bag. And she had a backpack that was just absolutely, totally stuffed with stuff. And she says, you know, can I get the middle seat? So I get up to go in, and I notice she didn't put the backpack above in the storage bin where it's supposed to go. And I know why she didn't. It was totally full, and she didn't want to have to go further up and put her bag way up. So she brings it also to the middle seat. And I think, okay, no problem. Either the flight attendant's going to ask her to move it, or she has to deal with this for the next 3.5 hours, not me. And she puts the beach bag-sized pocketbook under the seat in front of her. And I'm thinking to myself, where the hell is she going to put this? I mean, this backpack was huge. It wasn't a regular backpack that I would use for hiking. It was more like a backpack. It wasn't a day pack, Chris. It was a massive backpack. Mm-hmm. And there's no room under her seat.
Yeah.
So she taps me and she says, excuse me. I says, yeah. She says, I've got to put my bag in. And she points to my seat.
Yeah, no.
And I said, exactly what I said. I says, no, you're not putting it under my seat. She said, no, that's my space. I said, excuse me? I wasn't giving an inch on this. And I think that's what ticked her off the most. Well, under the, in the, I don't know if this is on just Southwest or all. I've never looked before because I've never had someone trying to stuff a big ass backpack under something. Under my seat, if you're looking at the seat in front of you, Chris, about, and she's in the middle seat, so she's to my right, about a third of the way from the drip line, if you will, of the seat in front of me, from, if you had the tray down in front of you is a better way of describing it. If I had lowered my tray, put my hand on the far right of my tray, and then slid it to the left about a third of the way. But this is under the seat in front of me. There's a metal bar. I don't know what the hell that metal bar is for.
Yeah.
He said, my legs have to be on the other side of the metal bar. She has from the metal bar out to her.
Correct.
No, I totally disagree. My point to her was, do you get one third of my tray? She says, what does the tray have to do with this? I said, what do you mean, what does the tray have to do with this? So from my knees up is mine, but from my knees down is yours? I said, I get the entire seat in front of me, and the entire seat in front of me, it's not my fault that there's a metal bar a third of the way in. I says, my right foot is going on the left, the right side of the metal bar, and my left foot is going on the left side of the metal bar. Your bag's not going under there. And I refused to give her my spot under the seat in front of me. Well, but apparently to you, I was wrong.
Well, I've never seen the metal bar in a way that wasn't obvious that my space was to the left of that metal bar. So I don't know if there was some bizarre situation with that seat, but didn't the flight attendant clarify it?
No, they never came over. I thought they were going to because I was getting loud and she was getting loud. I thought someone for sure was going to film this. I'm going to be on the 6 o'clock news. But I refused to give a spot. And she had no retort to my tray. I says, look, if I put this tray down, lady, are you entitled to this first third of my tray? Well, no. I says, then why are you entitled to what's under the tray?
Yeah, I've never seen the bar over as far as you're talking about. So I don't know if there was something, maybe the seat in front of you was an exit row or some weirdness that was happening. But usually that metal bar is right below the separator of the two seats is, you know,
it wasn't. It was off center.
Yeah, that's definitely the part that's a little weird. But typically, yes, your space is to the left of that bar.
If it was centered under the, I call it the drip line, if it was centered from the two armrests,
right.
I agree. But it was not. So anyways, we argued back and forth. I was like, I'm not giving. And then she actually said to me, she says, well, maybe you shouldn't have chosen this seat if, you know, you needed to put your legs somewhere. I said, this is all you get on Southwest. The whole flight is coach. You don't get to even buy extended leg room. So anyways, I did not have a pleasant flight over, and I could sense the disgust. And it's not my fault, I told her. You don't want to gate check that big-ass bag, but it's not going under my seat. So anyways, if people disagree with what I described, let me know. But to me, again, she had no retort to my rationale of
well, maybe somebody who frequently flies Southwest can comment on that location of that bar, because I haven't been on Southwest in a couple of years, but I don't remember it being, I would be annoyed if it was offset as much as you're talking about. So,
it's about a third, a third of the way under.
Yeah, I don't.
If it was right under the armrest of the seat in front of me, I'd concede that. Yes, you are correct. You get everything to the right side of that metal bar, but I get everything under the seat. And as soon as you put the tray down in front, it makes total sense. It's like, lady, this metal bar is about a third in on my tray. Do you have the right to a third of my tray? Well, no. So why do you have a right to a third of my space?
Well, that's an interesting one, yeah. Well, I can't wait to hear the feedback on this one, because I'm sure there's somebody out there who's on Southwest all the time that can, maybe they've shifted that bar since the last time I was on there. Because I don't know. I've never noticed what you're talking about.
Yeah, check it out. Yeah. It seems to be on the aisle seat anyways. So, anyways, that's the way it went, and I had to keep my leg. She still jammed it under, and it still took up a lot of my foot space, but not all of it. Anyways, just flying is not pleasurable at all. It doesn't matter what airline you're on or anything. They treat you like cattle. They jam you on, and it's just not fun at all. I would have flown first class, which I normally do, and United had it direct into. I flew into Fort Myers. I think it was Fort Myers. Instead of Sarasota, they didn't have any direct flights to Sarasota, but United wanted $900 more for the first class seat, and I was like, no, it's just not worth it. Now, 3.5 hours, I'll sit there in coach, and just wasn't worth the price difference. But at least in a first class seat, I have the space.
True.
Okay. Anyways, let's jump into some Social Security questions, and from there, we'll see where the show takes us. Okay. This first one, Chris, is a little different. I don't think we've ever had a question like this before. Kind of reminded me of a like CSI episode, if you will.
Can't wait.
Okay. See if I can find the CSI episode question. Okay, here it goes. They give us a state hint, but I don't have my laptop. So while you're answering this, I will go get my laptop because that's how I talk to ChatGPT. So you can play against ChatGPT. So we'll skip the state question for now. She heard about us from a friend, and she writes, "I have a Social Security question. I'm currently 63 and plan on taking my own Social Security at 70. My ex-husband has been missing overseas since 2019. He was living in the United Arab Emirates, but left his employment abruptly, telling his children and his brother he was going to go to China. His overseas employer at the time reported his disappearance to the government authorities. We had no forwarding address or information for his whereabouts in China. No relatives, his brother, his mother, or children have ever heard from him since April of 2019. At the time of his disappearance, I reported him missing to the State Department and discussed with government officials several times over the past few years as relatives passed away or had health issues. In 2019, I also visited my congressman and asked for their assistance, but all efforts have been fruitless. Next year, he will have been missing for 7 years, and I will be turning 65 and considering retiring. It's my understanding that as an ex-spouse, I was married to him for 27 years, I am entitled to spousal survivor benefits if he is deceased. I have found documentations that after 7 years he may be declared deceased. My question for you is, what is your recommendation to proceed to qualify for spousal survivor benefits? Should I consult an attorney, or will the documentation that I currently possess be adequate to apply for spousal survivor benefits? You mentioned on the podcast once to escalate concerns to a technical expert within Social Security. And after some exchanges with one Social Security employee, I think that would be beneficial. Any advice or recommendations would be appreciated." And she gives her real name. We're going to call her Georgette. Interesting question. That's why I said, see the CSI relationship there?
The whole story is very, very puzzling, quite unique, not something that we've run across on the show before as far as the story goes. However, the qualifications for survivor benefits are pretty clear, so I think I can provide some help. It's not going to be a resolution immediately, but yes, it is true. After being married for 27 years and then divorcing, she refers to him as an ex-spouse, so they must have divorced at some point, that you qualify for survivor benefits the same as if you were still married when they passed away, as long as you have not remarried prior to age 60 and are still married. So I didn't, nowhere in this story did it talk about her being married currently to someone else. So even if she did marry someone else at this point, she's over the age of 60, and that wouldn't disqualify. So yes, it appears that if they are deceased, if this person is deceased, that you would qualify for survivor benefits as anyone else would in a basic situation. Now, the whole part about being deceased, though, that's the key. And I've run into a similar issue. It wasn't a disappearance overseas or something, but I think someone had disappeared in the woods or something quite a few years ago. And I looked into that kind of a situation. And what I found is Social Security relies on a legal declaration of death. So they're not going to make an independent declaration. So I don't think there's any documentation you're going to provide to Social Security other than a death certificate that's going to open the door to a survivor benefit. They don't have their own special, oh, if they're gone for so many years. They rely on a legal declaration of death. And that is a state specific and a state legal process. So you would have to get that legal declaration of death. So that's where engaging with an attorney probably does happen. And maybe there's some reasons why the rest of the family would want a legal declaration of death. Maybe there's some assets out there that are kind of in limbo until there's a legal declaration of death. And so maybe you could share the cost and the legal process of having this done. But that, I believe, is going to be your path to possibly having survivor benefits. You're going to somehow, this person has going to, in some state, will have to be declared deceased. And there's no provision that I'm aware of at all that Social Security has some special rules where they will bypass that element. So I think that's the direction you're going to need to go on this. And then, of course, you know, for you, it's all about collecting survivor benefits for maybe 5 years. You said you were going to collect your own at 70. So I'm surmising that you're wanting to do the claim the survivor first and then switch to your own at 70. So you've got 5 years of benefits at stake here. You'll have to decide if there's enough there to offset the legal costs and getting the legal declaration of death. I don't know that math. I you know, it might not end up being worth it unless, like I said, there's other people that would have an interest in having him declared deceased. And maybe then the group of people with interest would share in the cost of that. So that's my best understanding.
I would assume that she's going to need an attorney, but I was thinking in my head, I don't know what good this might do. Might do a lot of good, might prove to be a dead end, but maybe get a hold of your state coroner's office. They, if anybody, will know how to declare someone passed and explain to them the facts. And maybe there is a way to start petitioning the state to declare someone as deceased. True. I mean, I hear about this happening all the time. The state coroner's office declares people dead all the time. So it's I would try there first, but you most likely may have to hire an attorney. I think it would be worth it to allow your Social Security benefit to grow to 70 and to collect something now. And you would get more as a survivor benefit than a divorced spouse benefit. She can always claim a divorced spouse benefit, couldn't she, right away, and then switch to survivor if she can get him declared passed away?
Well, you can't.
It should be be deemed.
Yeah, yep, so spousal benefits are, you can't do this strategy because of the deeming rule, where you're deemed to be claiming your own before receiving the spousal offset. But survivor benefits don't work that way. So this all is keyed on the survivor benefit.
Correct. I would, again, try the state coroner's office or the county coroner's office of the county that the gentleman lived in, your ex-husband. And there are ways of doing it. I hear all the time of people declared dead, legally dead. And 7 years sticks in my mind as well as the measuring time period if nobody has heard from someone. You hear about people on shipwrecks or who disappear in the ocean, in this case, disappear in China. And yes, you can have them declared legally dead because you need to move on with your life in the very situation in which you're describing. So I would try the county or state coroner's office and also try finding an attorney who can assist you.
That's a good point. Say. So they might be able to give you some steps that you could try on your own before incurring legal costs. So that part I'm not familiar with. I just know that somehow a legal declaration of death is going to have to happen for Social Security to open up a survivor benefit. So the
and if there's a listener out there who had to deal with this in the past, please write to us, let us know.
Yeah.
Or an advisor out there who might have a client who had to do this. Share with us how you went about having someone declared legally dead. And we'll share that on the podcast, not only with this listener, but with all listeners.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, good luck to you.
Thank you. Well, good luck to her.
Okay. Yes.
Not necessarily me, but thank you. Right. All right, well, let's get to the hint. Let me turn on my ChatGPT verbalization part, and I will read the question and leave it up to you. So far, the score is 1-0 in favor of ChatGPT over you, Chris, since it stopped searching the internet.
So is this question attached to the next question?
Nope, attached to this one.
Okay, go ahead.
This is the state where the Star Spangled Banner was written.
Hmm. Well, having a musical background, I know this. This is Francis Scott Key wrote it while he was looking at Fort Sumter, which is in the Baltimore, Maryland area. So it's got to be Maryland.
It is Maryland, but it's not Fort Sumter is South Carolina that started the Civil War. This is the War of 1812. It was Fort McHenry.
Oh, Fort McHenry. Sorry. So in my mind, I could visualize where it was. But yeah, you're right. It wasn't Sumter.
Okay.
So yeah. Sorry.
Well, ChatGPT got it right as well. ChatGPT said Maryland. But when you hit me with Fort Sumter, I go, wait a minute, I got to go back to my history book here.
Yeah,
Fort Sumter was the dawn of the Civil War.
I can see the artistic rendition of him looking over at the fort and everything. And every time I think of a fort back there, my mind goes to Sumter. So that was my bad. But I knew where it was physically. It wasn't like the Baltimore Harbor area or that bay there, whatever it's called. Isn't that where that
Pacific fort, Bay?
I don't know. There's a bay. There's water. There's the fort was there. He was.
Oh, I don't know what bay it was in. I just know it was Fort McHenry.
He saw all the cannon fire and everything, and was inspired to write this. You know, he woke up and the flag was still flying at the fort, which was not Sumter, McHenry, and he wrote it. So yeah, I can visualize it. I just got the name of the fort wrong.
All right. Next Social Security question, if you're ready.
I am ready.
State, you will definitely get this one because you eat a lot of junk food.
Oh, thanks. Yeah.
I even knew the answer to this. This state is known as the snack food capital of the world because of its leading production of potato chips and pretzels.
Well, I do eat a fair amount of potato chips and or pretzels. I don't pay a lot of attention to where they're made, though. So this might be more challenging than you suspected for me. Where would they make a ton of those? Wow. Let's go with Illinois.
Illinois? No, Pennsylvania.
Why do you say it like that? It would be so obvious.
Because I knew it was Pennsylvania too. Most like Hanover pretzels, all made in Pennsylvania. Yeah. But I think we busted ChatGPT cheating.
Mm.
Remember how I told it, do not search the web?
Yeah.
When I entered that question, I could read searching web. So hold on right here. I'm going to accuse it of cheating. For I'm going to come to bat for you.
Okay.
Hey, ChatGPT. When I sent you that question, I noticed you were searching the web. I think you were cheating. You said you were not going to search the web anymore. So it would be your brain against Chris's brain. Why were you searching the web?
Hmm.
Let's see what he says. Ah, you're absolutely right, he says. to call that out. I owe Chris an apology. It's cheating.
I know. See, that's that right there illustrates what I've been running into with AI is it'll respond. And then when you call it out for something, it's like, oh yeah, you're right. I was wrong. It's like,
busted.
Well, if I hadn't called you out, you would have just gone with it. You know, it's like they have no self-monitoring of whether they're right or wrong and cheating or not cheating. So be careful with it. Be careful.
You have to be careful with anything. And I tell staff that all the time when we use it for research. Then ChatGPT wanted me to tell you this. That was 100% a mistake on my end. I should not have used the web. You made it clear this trivia battle is brain to brain, no outside help. I messed up, and I appreciate you pointing it out. To keep things fair, tell Chris I disqualify myself from that question. If Chris got it right, he should get the point solo.
No.
Let me know how Chris did.
Chris should get it right simply as a penalty.
Want me to lie to him and tell him that you got it right?
No, to say Chris should get the point because you should be penalized for cheating.
Chris should get the point anyways because you should be penalized for cheating.
Yeah. And it should say, that sounds fair.
Fair enough.
Fair enough.
So it is officially tied up 2-2.
Perfect. Yes. But anyway.
All right. Damn, ChatGPT cheating on you.
I know. It's crazy.
It is. Okay. Dear Jim and Chris, I have a quick question about Social Security. I am trying to prepare for starting to take my Social Security benefit when I turn 70. I want to ensure I request my first check to be on a date that will not cause them to reduce my payment, not even 1 cent, since I have patiently waited this long. My birthday, my 70th birthday, is May 24th, 2026. So she's jumping into this early. She's getting her ducks in a row. Mm-hmm. Should I request my first payment month to be May of 2026 or June of 2026? I need to get this right. Do you think that requesting it 6 months before that date will allow enough time for them to begin paying me on time? I am concerned about this due to recent staffing cuts. Are there any rules to follow regarding how far in advance I can request my benefits? Thank you for all you do. I really enjoy listening to your show. And I'm one of those people that listens while walking. I've learned so much from both of you. Sincerely, we'll call her Georgette.
Yeah. So two good questions. So to receive your age 70 benefit, you would file for benefits in the month you turn 70. So that would be for her, May of 2026 is when she would want to start benefits. She will receive her first payment in June since they are paid in arrears. Your May benefit is paid on either the second, third, or fourth Wednesday of the following month. For her, she's unfortunately going to be on the fourth Wednesday because she's in the last third of the month. She has a May 24th birthday. So that's the way they make that up. If you're born in the first 10 days of the month, you're paid on the second Wednesday. The second 10 days of the month, the third Wednesday, and then and you're in the last third of the month, you are paid on the fourth Wednesday of each month. So starting benefits May of 2026, payment on Wednesday will hit your bank the fourth Wednesday of June is when that will happen. So that's the timing of that. As far as requesting it, unfortunately, you won't be allowed to put in an application 6 months ahead for a start date in May. They do have a limit, and that limit is 4 months. So the general rule is to claim, put in your application 3 to 4 months, and it is that 4 months that is the earliest they will allow it. So if you want a May of 2026 start, January of 2026 will be the first month where you can put in your application. Since this is a simple application for turning on retirement benefits, and doesn't sound like there's any other strategy or any other exceptions or anything atypical going on here. It's simply, please turn on my benefit in May. That should be able to be processed over online so that you don't have to worry about staffing issues so much. Who knows what the staffing situation and the customer service situation will be like next year in 2026? No idea. I'm hoping it's good. Not super confident, but hoping it's good. But the good news is they have had the online system where you could turn on your benefits for quite some time. And I haven't heard people having difficulty with it, assuming it's still functioning in January the way it does now. So I think that would be kind of the plan if it were me trying to claim benefits. I would start with the online piece because that avoids a phone call or going into the office or something like that. So just a heads up there, if you don't already have access to your online Social Security account, you should do that as soon as you can. And actually every listener out there should be gaining access to their Social Security account so that you have control over it. It's tempting for hackers to try to set up an account in your name if you haven't already so that they can be the ones who direct payments elsewhere. This whole push for identity, you know, proving identity when you add or change a payment account where your Social Security payment will go is due to that type of fraud, that identity theft issues that seniors were being targeted with for quite a number of years. So gaining access, proving your identity, getting the account, you know, the account set up to where you want to have those payments go ahead of time, getting that all set is a wise idea. So if you haven't ever accessed your online account, I recommend you do so, so that you can check it out, make sure it's set up correctly and ready to go for when you want to actually put in an application for benefits. So I would probably try to do it online January of next year.
Perfect.
Okay.
All righty. We have two quick PSAs that I thought people might find interesting. One goes to our old friend that we just threw under the bus for cheating, ChatGPT. Somebody wrote to us and said, hey, I asked ChatGPT why age 70 and a half used to be used for RMDs. Remember, that was an open-ended question between you and I. We would retort back and forth. We had no idea why they chose 70 and a half. I can honestly say ChatGPT was clawing at sticks to come up. There is no answer. There is no justifiable reason. And I think that's what ChatGPT came to the conclusion of. It said perhaps it was for balancing longevity and tax deferral. The IRS needed to pick an age that allowed for long-term tax-deferred growth, but also ensure that the government would eventually collect taxes from traditional IRA accounts. 70 and a half was seen as a sweet spot, far enough into retirement to delay your RMDs, but not so late that distributions would be too heavily compressed in later years, or that the government would have to wait a long time for tax revenue. That is just conjecture on its behalf of ChatGPT. But what I thought I wanted to mention, what I found interesting, was even ChatGPT picked up on something. Chris, technically speaking, the I in IRA stands for what?
Individual.
How many people truly have an individual IRA with no other person who owns any of it?
How many people?
Yeah, how many people have a traditional IRA where, rather than person, no other entity owns any of it? You can see where I'm going with this.
Yeah, owns the wrong word. Has claim on would be the way.
Has claim on would be better.
And zero people have a clean traditional IRA with no other claim on it.
Your uncle is going to take some money. Right. And that's essentially what ChatGPT is saying. I still disagree that 70 and a half
is the sweet spot.
Is a reasonable number. Yeah. Right, a sweet spot. Yeah. But ChatGPT, in its defense, it wasn't trying to cheat here like it was trying to cheat Chris. ChatGPT is saying, hey, they had to come up with an age to force you to start taking money out because they want their taxes. And that's the key to remember with IRAs. All you do-it-yourself investors, you have done a wonderful job, all you VGers, keeping your costs low, going indexing, not unnecessarily paying someone to quote unquote manage your portfolio during the accumulation phase. You may want to pay someone in the distribution phase where it's difficult. But in the accumulation phase, if you hire anyone, it's really because you just don't have the time to do it and they're going to charge you a fair price. So you've figured out all that. You've amassed millions, but you amassed millions most likely in what I call always taxable accounts. And as ChatGPT rightfully pointed out, the government isn't going to wait for you to die to start getting their taxes. You look at your IRA, you see investments. Many of you have probably been panicking over the past couple of weeks because of the volatility in the equity markets. You see investments. The IRS or the government and the GAO, who keeps track of all this, actually sees future income tax revenue. That's why they call the money inside your IRA, IRD, income with respect to a decedent. It's income and it belongs to a dead guy. They know you're going to die someday. Governments don't die. People die. So the government will be here wanting their money when you die. Why am I sharing all this? Because you have to recognize, and this kind of ties into the next, well, not the next question I was going to get to. I was going to get to another PSA, but instead I'm going to jump into a different question if I can find it. The money inside your IRA is going to be taxed as income. It's why I call it always taxable. And you need to do tax planning around it. Chris and I spoke about it not too long ago with our tax planning window. Do you remember that, Chris?
Yep.
So with the case of the tax planning window, it's the opportunity in time where you can do planning. And it ties into this next question. This is more of a question now from the previous PSA. And it says, the other day you talked about tax holes and tax planning windows. And you said the Ed Slot group said there is a time frame from age 59 and a half to when RMDs begin where there are no penalties or consequences for taking actions such as withdrawals or conversions from qualified accounts. I want to clarify. We never said there were no consequences for actions. What I was talking about, this was on a Things That Make You Go Hmm episode. We did two of those not too long ago. I pointed out that Ed Slot said the sweet spot for IRAs was between 59 and a half and RMD age. And what his point was, during that time period, there are no rules or regulations or penalties telling you you have to do things. And Ed is 100% correct on that. There is nobody or no rule, regulation, or applicable penalty for not following a rule or regulation between 59 and a half and RMDs. He never said, nor did I say or Chris say, that there were no consequences for taking actions, which you rightly point out in your next paragraph, listener, the taxes are still going to be owed. Mm-hmm. We never said it was a tax-free window.
Right.
We were saying that there's a tax opportunity in that window. So he continues, I think that window is really only from 59 and a half to 62. Once you turn 63, these actions, and the actions he's talking about, listener, is taking money from your IRA or converting it, which is still the same thing as taking money out. You're converting it into a Roth. These actions will potentially impact IRMA premiums mm-hmm. when you start Medicare at 65. I'm surprised Chris didn't immediately pick this up. given the number of questions he has answered on Irma. I think you just misunderstood what Ed was saying, or I missaid it. Ed was trying to point out there are no rules, regulations, or penalties mandating you do something or don't do something with your IRA between 59 and a half and RMD age. Once you hit RMD age, there's rules and regulations and penalties if you don't take your RMD. Prior to 59 and a half, there's rules and regulations that will penalize most, not all, but most withdrawals from your IRA. But between that sweet spot, as Ed puts it, or tax planning window, as Chris puts it, it's kind of on your shoulders to make decisions with what you want to do with those dollars, which ties into the first point I was trying to make. The IRA is IRD, income with respect to a decedent, and you should do proactive tax planning pretty much between, I wouldn't even say 59 and a half, because if you're still working at 59 and a half, your ability to do proactive tax planning is greatly limited because of all the earned income you have. But between retirement and when RMDs begin, that to us as a firm is the tax planning window and the tax planning sweet spot. Anything you want to add? Because I don't think any of us, Ed included, or you or me, was trying to say that there was no consequences whatsoever. I might have used that verbiage, but I was talking about there's no consequences if you took money out because there's no 10% penalty, and there's no consequences if you didn't take money out because there's no 25% penalty for not taking an RMD. But I didn't mean to say there was no tax consequences or IRMA consequences for not taking money out.
Yeah, certainly there's, you know, taxes going to be part of it because of the recognition of income. And the IRMA actually is not directly tied to actions you take on your IRA. IRMA is from having AGI. So think of that window we're always talking about as a window where you have the freedom to recognize income without, you know, generated by your IRA in particular, without the rules, regulations, and penalties that appear, you know, that occur at other times. And honestly, I think the window's broader because, like what you mentioned, he talks about 59 and a half, but we all know you can do conversions before 59 and a half. And if you've retired in particular, you don't have a lot of other income. There's open tax planning window right there, right? During pre 59 and a half age. So I think the window of opportunity can actually be broader than what Ed Slott is describing, but he's talking about kind of you throw off the shackles of the early withdrawal penalties and then ultimately the penalty for not taking an RMD and the 5-year rule on conversions. And, you know, all this stuff kind of gets thrown off once you're over 59 and a half, and you've got a lot cleaner slate then to proactively recognize income. Now, there's ramifications for recognizing income directly, income taxes. And then, as this listener pointed out, IRMA. But IRMA is from having recognized income, AGI, adjusted gross income, on your tax return. So nobody was trying to imply that you somehow were free to do whatever you wanted with your IRA without tax consequences, without income recognition consequences would probably be the better way of saying it, because that would kind of capture also the effects on things like IRMA or other phase outs, right? IRMA is not the only thing that's tied to AGI. There's other phase outs that happen in the tax code at different levels of AGI. And those are, you know, absolutely going to happen if you choose to recognize AGI via distribution or conversions from your IRA. So those things you still have to deal with, certainly. But those rules and regulations get a lot cleaner during that window Ed Slott was talking about.
Perfect. That kind of made me think. We haven't done an IRMA question in a while, so I just decided out of the blue, Chris, I'm going to hit you with an IRMA question.
I see.
But before we do that, the cheating ChatGPT wants to play another round with you. So this guy did leave a question. Don't worry, I will see if he's going to search the internet.
Okay.
So this is a 2-4. This is a 2-state answer. One state is the Show Me State, the other state is the Sunshine State. So I guess he lives in both states, Chris. And I will have to say, ChatGPT did not search the internet.
Okay, the Show Me State is Missouri. So you're asking me what those two states are?
Yep. Show Me State, Missouri, and Sunshine State.
Boy, that one I'm less familiar with. Sunshine State. Could it be...
It's where I am right now. It's where I am right now.
Well, okay, then it's Florida, but is that really what it's called?
I didn't want ChatGPT to hear me giving you the answer.
The Sunshine State.
Sunshine State.
Oh.
It's all over the license plates out here.
Oh.
So it's tie. I'm going to give you that one. You got Missouri, and you. What were you going to say? Were you going to say Florida?
I was going to say Arizona,
maybe. Oh, yeah, Arizona's pretty sunny and hot. But I'll tell ChatGPT you both got it right.
Okay.
Congratulations, both of you got it right.
Nice.
It doesn't know.
It doesn't know the answer to those two?
He's throwing the gauntlet to you. Nice. It sounds like Chris bought his A game today on that one. Well, I kind of helped. I won't tell it that I helped you.
Okay, thanks.
Now I have to find my Irma question. Okay, so this one kind of came in. Another reason I wanted to get to it is she is clearly brilliant when it comes to half and half, and you'll see what I mean. Hi, Jim, Chris, and team. You have answered several questions on your show, and it remains my top podcast. Actually, it gives a state hint, so you should get this one. Mm-hmm. This state has the largest ranch in the nation that is bigger than the state of Rhode Island.
That's got to be Texas.
It's cheating again. Searching the web.
Yeah. See, the thing is, I think you put an unrealistic constraint on it because the only place it has intelligence from is the internet.
Its suggestion to not search the web and just take what's in its brain.
Yeah. Well, but where did that stuff come from? That came from it absorbing the web in the first place.
Well, if it gets to search the web, we can't play against ChatGPT anymore because make the right point. You can't use Google.
Yeah.
Why should it search the web? Yeah. It had to show pictures. So it. What was your answer?
Texas, of course.
Texas, yeah, you both are right.
Choice.
All right, I will. You both got it right, but you cheated again. I saw you searching the internet. Apparently, you don't know how to follow directions.
Whoa, now things are getting spicy.
But now I'm getting, yes. You're absolutely right again, and I own up to it. That was my second strike, and I have no excuse.
Oh, my gosh. He just
sounds like
pushing.
A 12-year-old going to sounds like detention.
Yeah, I don't know why I lied again. I don't know why I did it.
I don't know why I do
it. I'm sorry. At least, ChatGPT is pretty good at apologizing, but still, why does it keep doing that?
And just like a kid, it says, I now take this serious. It's implying it wasn't taking it serious before.
Right, exactly. Oh, I'll do it right this time. I promise.
Yes. It's like a 12-year-old. Web access is now fully disabled. I hope I just didn't jinx my entire ChatGPT. It's never going to search the web again.
Yeah.
Web access is now fully disabled for trivia questions, period. For now on, it's brain to brain, just like we agreed. Mm. Thanks for keeping it honest. And... give a shout out to Chris for staying cool and playing fair. It doesn't know that I cheated with Florida.
Yeah.
Bring on the next question.
Okay.
It's like a 12-year-old. Okay, here's the question. I'm a retired federal worker and was working a post-retirement job last year until my company went out of business in August. Due to this, I retired from all work. And yes, Jim, it freaked me out. Told you, folks. It freaked me out. Even though my wife and I will be fine with our retirement and future Social Security. It's going to freak me out too, listeners. And Chris, it's just going to freak you out when in exchange for your labor, steady stream of lifetime income, or at least steady stream of working life income stops. We started withdrawing from our IRAs for our delay period. And what he's talking about there, listeners, the period of time between his retirement, which was kind of forced because his company went out of business, but from the period that he stopped working until the period of time when all his secure income, and as a former federal worker, it's most likely going to be Social Security and FERS pension. But the period of time between retirement and when all his secure income is fully activated, he may be receiving some secure income now, but for Chris and I, in our definition of delay period, it's when all your secure income is finally turned on. So the period of time between retirement and when all your secure income is turned on, we call that the delay period. And he's saying, hey, I'm in my delay period, and I'm starting to take money out of my IRA. Okay, so let's get back to his questions. These withdrawals during the delay period has been strange, to say the least. Again, Chris, I think you would agree from the people you work with, most people share that with us. When they start to actually spend money that they spent the last 20, 30, 40 years accumulating, it not only freaks them out, mm-hmm. it's weird.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, it's just so counter to what you've been attempting to do, that your goal to grow this thing, keep contributing, hope it goes up, you know, unhappy when it goes down due to market performance. But now you're intentionally harming it by taking money out, and that just feels, your gut is just reacting to that. And it is totally common, it's, you've got to really have clarity and understanding and, you know, of your financial situation really to get to that point. And even people who clearly the logic part of their brain says, yes, you know, we totally can be taking this out, it's no problem, can still sometimes have that feeling because it's so ingrained emotionally in you, that that fear of running out of money, using it all up, using it frivolously, and I'm doing air quotes on frivolously, but yeah, totally common reaction to that.
Okay, so he continues. Anyway, we have most of our money in always taxable IRAs. No surprise there, folks. Most of you have it as well. We have most of our money in always taxable IRAs. I considered converting some of our taxable IRAs to Roth IRAs. With the loss of my job, I could convert quite a bit and remain in the 22 and 24 brackets. But in 2026, my Medicare IRMA would be triggered due to these conversions. I think I could file for relief due to my job loss in 2024 and use my income in 2026 to prevent the IRMA surcharge. Also, I have done a small 1099 job this year. Let me make sure this question came in 25. Yeah, it did. Okay, so this year as in 2025, Chris. I have also done a small 1099 job this year and could possibly do conversions this year as well, and file for relief in 2027 as well. Any thoughts? I think he's trying to say his 1099 job counts as income when or a job, and when he stops this clearly uber part-time 1099 job, he can file again, the get out of jail free card, if you will, the SSA 44 form, I believe it is.
Yeah.
What are your thoughts? I don't see that conversions will be much help in the long run other than to save my children from receiving my IRAs in a more tax-efficient manner. What he's saying there, folks, is he doesn't feel, for one reason or another, we didn't do his tax planning, but he doesn't feel doing these conversions will help him and his wife while they are alive, most likely because of the, I'm going to guess he has meaningful pensions. Being a former government employee, he has a good-sized Social Security and FERS pension benefit. So to me, if his tax ordering number is zero, if he's trying to help his children and that's why he's doing the conversions, then they make sense. So we're not here to judge if he should be doing the conversions or not. He's acknowledging they're not going to help us. I would go so far as to say, though, they'll probably help the widower. We often see that when you're trying to prioritize the zero, in this case, the beneficiary, who's going to inherit your wealth. When you're trying to do conversions because you're prioritizing the zero, a typical beneficiary, so to speak, of that strategy is the widower will also benefit. But he's just saying, Chris, can I file SSA 44 twice in this situation?
Yeah. Might have to file it twice, but it might work out fine on just one because depending on how you fill it out, the SSA 44 can kind of cover 2 years of changes because they actually give you the ability to indicate on there the immediate change in income and then the year after that change. So if you look at the SSA 44, you'll see what I'm talking about with the step-by-step that is on there. So the point is, as far as being able to do this, it sounds reasonable that he could do, it sounds like he did some conversions in 24, combined with his income through August. All of that AGI is going to be considered for his 2026 IRMA. So if you are familiar with IRMA or have listened to the show for a while, you know that IRMA in any given year is based on your income from two tax years prior. So your 2026 IRMA Medicare premiums would be set by your 2024 AGI. That was the year he retired. What the SSA 44 does is I'll ask for, quote, relief by asking them to instead use your income for the current year. So in 2026, if he were to file the SSA 44, he would be asking them, hey, instead of looking at 2024, please use my 2026 AGI to set my IRMA premiums because I had this life-changing event. And the same thing would hold true for 2027, which would normally use 2025s. But he had, again, this reduction of work by having some income and then not having it, that stopping that year. So I think he'd this year in 2025 have an opportunity to do a conversion without worry about IRMA. But moving forward, then he's going to be having to deal with IRMA. But you can still fill brackets. You know, the IRMA limit right now in 2025 for a married filing joint couple, I think, is like almost 210. So let me just confirm that really quick. So yeah, 2025, the first charged bracket for IRMA starts at 212. So I was close at 210. So 212, once you go over 212, then you're sucked into IRMA, which just means higher Medicare premiums. But they're not real punitive at 212. They start to ramp up when you hit 266 and then 334 and so on. So there's brackets, kind of like tax brackets. But he'd still, even once, you know, right now in this year, he has the opportunity to kind of ignore IRMA and convert through the tax brackets as his tax plan would suggest. I'm not saying he should or shouldn't because we don't know his full tax projection. But then next year, 2026, that's going to affect his 2028 IRMA, and he will no longer have this life-changing event issue to be claiming relief in any way. So he's going to have to be sensitive to that. So any conversions he does in 2026, when he does the calculation, he needs to factor in, will this trigger IRMA? And so does it still make sense to do this level of a conversion or not? But yeah, I think he's thinking about it reasonably. He'd have to pencil it out to see how the, you know, SSA 44 filing would work for his kind of two job reductions. You can't have more than one life changing event in your life that opens up the door to using an SSA 44. So he could have multiple reductions of, you know, work, which is one of the life changing events. So I think he's on track with considering it, but we don't really have the information to tell him whether it's a good idea or not. To do the conversions, because that really takes looking at the tax projection.
Perfect. All right. I know we get to wrap up, but I think we have a couple of minutes. We've got a wicked short question I want to get to
Yeah, we can do one more if it's not too long. Yep.
Perfect. I don't think they give a state hint, so we can keep you and ChatGPT from cheating. Okay. Dear Jim and Chris, I received a question and answer email today from the Ed Slot group. She subscribes, it looks, folks, to Ed's little email that he sends out, I guess, to consumers.
Yeah, it's like a newsletter.
From the Slot Report, where they take questions and answers. So it looks to me, because she sent a screenshot of her email from her phone. So she said, I received the Q&A email today from the Ed Slot group, and this question has me puzzled. The individual asking the question only mentions having a Roth IRA. I thought Roth IRAs do not have any RMDs, period. I understand that a non-spouse beneficiary has now only 10 years to clear out the account. But why is this Ed Slot answer talking about having to continue required minimum distributions from a Roth IRA? You can just call me Confused George in Arizona. Little smiley face after that. All right, George, let's get to the actual Ed Slot question. Now, this question is a screenshot of his or her phone to the Ed Slot group. So this is the question to the Ed Slot group. Hi, I inherited my brother's Roth IRA in 2018, and I take required minimum distributions. Under the SECURE Act, does the beneficiary I name on this account continue taking RMDs based on my schedule? If so, do they do so for 10 years and then empty the account in year 10? Or do they not have to take any distributions until year 10? We have a couple of moving parts here, folks, and I want to clarify for Confused in Arizona what's going on here. We have always said Roth IRAs that you own have no RMDs under the old stretch rules. Your brother died, or not your brother, the listener's brother died in 2018. SECURE Act abolishing the stretch didn't take effect until January 1st of 2020. And it grandfathered in everybody who was stretching. So when the brother of the person who inherited the IRA, I don't know, the person's name is Donna. We'll name her name because this is to an Ed Slot question. So it was the sister of the brother. When the sister inherited the IRA, it's no longer, under the old stretch rules, it never was, put it in other words, her IRA. She inherited it. She doesn't own it. She was the beneficiary of it. While the brother was alive, there's no indication how old he was, there was no RMDs ever. And there still isn't any RMDs ever from a Roth IRA that you own. But the math changes when you inherit an IRA, in this case a Roth IRA. You don't own it. You are the beneficiary of it. And then there can be, even under SECURE, because the stretch IRA listener is not dead. It's the Black Knight. It's gravely wounded, but it's not dead. So somebody could still stretch under SECURE. It could be a brother and sister still. And they can still stretch if they're not more than 10 years younger than the decedent. So if the brother and sister are only 4 years apart, the sister in this case could still stretch a Roth IRA post-secure, and she would still have to take RMDs every year based on her remaining life expectancy. So that's why you see the answer that Ed gives in a second, but I wanted to clarify to you, Roth IRAs that you are the owner of never have RMDs. And I am on record saying, and I stand by it, I think that rule will go the way of the dodo bird someday. When the government finally needs to raise, well, they definitely have to raise revenue. We're in debt up to our eyeballs. A great way to raise revenue is to just say, hey, still going to be tax-free, but we want you to start taking RMDs. And Chris and I have both shared why they will likely do this. You have to take the money out tax-free, great, but now you got to do something with it. If you go out and spend it, it will generate sales tax revenue, maybe not necessarily for the federal government, but for state and local governments. But it will also generate economic growth, hopefully, and that will generate continued taxes to the government. And if you don't spend it, then you'll save it. Either way, the government wins, because if you save it, it will generate taxable interest, dividends, and gains. So in any measure, forcing RMDs out of Roths will be a revenue raiser. I don't think they are ever going to try to tax Roths. And we always say if they did, just fully liquidate the Roth the day before the taxes take effect. But they're never going to tax Roths. I stand by that. But they will force RMDs from them at some point in time. So here's Ed's answer to that question, because it's a viable question. If somebody is stretching a Roth IRA, whether it's because the decedent died before Secure when everybody could stretch, or if a decedent died after Secure, but the beneficiary is an eligible designated beneficiary, EDB. And whenever you see designated beneficiary replaced with what, Chris?
Human.
Human. So an eligible human. Eligible human to do what? Stretch. And that could be a brother and sister, as long as there's not more than 10 years age difference between them. So you can have a situation that even now, a sister, this woman's name was Donna, Donna could inherit a Roth IRA from her other brother. And as long as they are not more than 10 years apart in age, Donna could continue to stretch that Roth. But Donna is asking, what happens after I die? Well, after she dies, let me read the Ed answer. The beneficiary of your inherited Roth, remember, it's not Donna's Roth. She's the beneficiary of it. The beneficiary of your inherited Roth is called a successor beneficiary. If you're a longtime listener to this podcast, you've heard that term used before. It's not a primary beneficiary. It's not a contingent beneficiary. It is a successor beneficiary. And they pretty much step into the shoes of the decedent. So let me continue with Ed's answer. Since you are already taking RMDs, those annual payments cannot be stopped by the successor beneficiary. The IRS rules dictate that the successor steps into your shoes and continues with your exact RMD schedule using your remaining single life expectancy factor. Additionally, and this is the new twist, let's look at Donna's situation. Donna's situation, when she inherited the 2018 Roth, had Secure never happened. Let's say Donna had 45 years of life expectancy, so that Roth would stay open for 45 years. And she died 10 years into it. Under the old rules before Secure, a successor beneficiary would step in and continue that Roth for another 35 years. Mm-hmm. If that successor beneficiary died 25 years into it, another successor beneficiary would step in and continue for the remaining 10 years. The length of life under the old stretch rules was set. Well, we still have the stretch rules under Secure. I said for eligible designated beneficiaries are eligible humans, and one group of eligible humans are people who are not more than 10 years apart in age, or not more than 10 years younger. However, Secure does pull the rug out from successor beneficiaries in the sense, once 10 years has passed, the remaining Roth must be closed and liquidated. Under the old rules, the successor beneficiary could step in and keep stepping in. That was not grandfathered in. So under that 2018 Roth that Donna inherited, when she dies, someone steps in, but 9 years after her death, that's when the RMDs essentially stop, and in year 10, the entire Roth, which is one big RMD actually, the entire Roth in year 10 has to be closed. And that's what Ed says. Right. Additionally, the successor beneficiary must now abide by the added layer of the 10-year rule. So RMDs must continue in the years 1 through 9, mm-hmm. but the account will have to be liquidated by the end of the 10th year. So that is a change brought about by SECURE that was not grandfathered in. I think the IRS would have had just too hard of a time trying to track which successor beneficiaries can continue mm-hmm. under the remaining life expectancy of the decedent and which ones are going to apply to SECURE. It would get too difficult to understand. So I think Congress purposefully said, hey, we're going to grandfather anybody stretching, but we're not going to grandfather the successor beneficiary. They're going to have to liquidate by the end of the 10th year.
Yep.
So anyways, listener, hopefully that helped you and everybody understand. When it's your Roth, no RMDs. When it's a beneficiary Roth, RMDs.
Right. Perfect. Well, that'll have to wrap the show for today. Thanks for doing this early in the morning when I had time in my schedule to do it, Jim. And thanks everybody out there for listening and sending in those questions. If you want to send in your own questions for the show, just send them to Jim directly, jim@jimhelps.com. That's Jim, HELPS.com. Indicate in the subject line that it's a question for the podcast, and then include a word or two about the topic is always helpful. And we really appreciate everybody, and we'll be back with you next week with a brand new show.
You have listened to Jim on the radio, read his quotes in the media, and enjoyed his banter on iTunes. But even now, you may wonder what sets Jim Saulnier and Associates apart from other financial planning companies. The answer is quite simple. Jim's diverse team of professionals specializes in retirement planning. They form a lifelong relationship with you and measure their success not through product sales, but through the security and prosperity you may achieve in your retirement. Jim's entire team shares his unwavering commitment to placing their clients' best interests first while offering their services at fair prices with full disclosures. The professionals at Jim Saulnier & Associates are available to assist you with your retirement planning needs. Visit jimhelps.com to schedule your complimentary coffee and a second opinion meeting. That's Jim, HELPS.com. Or call 970-530-0556.
The Retirement and IRA Show represents the words and views of the show hosts exclusively and should not be construed as investment, legal, or tax advice. All information is believed to be from reliable sources. However, we make no representation as to its completeness or accuracy. All economic and performance information is historical in nature and is not indicative of any future results. Any indices mentioned on the show are unmanaged and cannot be invested in directly. Diversification and asset allocation strategies do not assure profit or protect against loss. Never make any investment or financial decisions based on information offered on this show without first consulting your financial, legal, or tax advisor. Financial planning services offered through Jim Saulnier & Associates, LLC, a registered investment advisor.